Conference Committee, House and Senate, will come to order. Good morning. We do have a hard deadline this morning at 10:15, so we want to get to work here this morning. One of the most sought-after handouts at the Capitol is the 2010 jobs bill legislation description. If you remember, we had quite a conversation at our last tax conference committee regarding the TIF proposals, extending the deadline for TIF projects. And so there is a list of all the projects that would be affected, and want to make sure that members of our committee here and also members of the general public are aware of this list of projects that are being considered with that that extension of the deadline. This morning we also have some other potential agreements to adopt. I'm hoping that we can look at a couple of provisions, the ringtones and some of the streamlined sales tax provisions that we might actually be able to adopt this morning. So I'd ask members to look at that, and folks here from the public who testify might want to consider whether or not they want to testify regarding those provisions. And in the meantime, while we're waiting for folks to gather here this morning, we'd like to talk about SFIA, the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. We do have some folks from the Department of Revenue that are here to testify. John Hagan is here to testify about the background of that. There is quite a bit of history with respect to this program, and I'm sure Mr. Hagan can fill us all in. Mr. Hagan, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for the opportunity to appear before the committee. As Chair Orton mentioned, I'm here to talk about give you a little bit of history on the Sustainable Forest Program. The Sustainable Forest Program was created by legislation in the 2001 session. The law provides for a property to be enrolled in SFIA if it met all of the following conditions I'm going to identify. The land had to be 20 or more contiguous acres in size, and 50% or more of it had to meet the definition of forest land, which is included in statute. A forest management plan for the land had to be prepared by an approved plan writer, and it had to be implemented by the property owner. Timber harvesting and forest management guidelines must be used in conjunction with the timber harvesting or forest management activities that were being conducted on the land. The land had to be enrolled for a minimum of 8 years. There was a covenant that had to be recorded, which would require the land to be encumbered for that 8-year period. There was also a requirement the land could have no delinquent taxes, and there was an additional provision that if the land included more than 1,920 acres in size or enrolled area, that it had to be available to the public for non-motorized access for the purposes of hunting or recreating. As I mentioned, there had to be a covenant included with the land that provided or precluded the property owner from developing the land or using it for other types of property for non-forest use. For lands that were properly enrolled in the program, there was an incentive payment made to the landowner, which was a greater of three different components. Number one, the difference between the property tax that would have been paid on the land if it were valued as at an average statewide class rate for 2C land, the value per acre and its current use value per acre derived from income produced on stumpage price, tree growth, and tree growth rates. A second option for that, for how to calculate the payment, was an amount equal to 2/3 of the average property tax due on the acreage of Class 2C managed forest land on an average statewide value per acre based on a township average and a class rate of 1%. And the third option is simply a statutory provision that was incorporated some years back that the minimum payment, if the other payments were lower, the minimum payment of $7 would prevail. That was raised from $1.50, which was originally increased or included when the SFIA plan was originally enacted. Prior to the 2009 pay 2010 SFIA payment year, the payment was based partly upon the statewide value per acre for 2B lands, or I should say it was based exclusively on the calculation, including the 2B timberland classification. During a 2008 session, as you remember, there were some changes to the green acres classification, and one of the changes was a great expansion of the 2B classification. The 2B classification, which had formerly been timberlands exclusively devoted to the use of timber, was greatly expanded to include basically all kinds of rural vacant land. In fact, it was renamed rural vacant land. So basically all lands that were not in the process of being produced on, or were not productive land, were enrolled in the, or became part of the 2B classification more or less by default. As a result of this expansion, there was a great concern that the 2B classification no longer reflected an appropriate measure for the calculation of the SFIA classification, or the SFIA payment. We thought about this as a department, and we proposed that instead of using the 2B class, which is now, as I mentioned, greatly expanded to include all sorts of rural vacant lands, the 2C classification would be a much better measure than the 2B, and our desire was to keep the payment for moving a great deal. 2C class managed forest land consists of no less than 20 and not more than 1,920 acres statewide per taxpayer that has been managed under a forest management plan that meets the requirements of Chapter 290C, but is not enrolled in the Sustainable Forest Program. The SFIA change from 2B to 2C class incorporated in the department's 2009 legislative bill and enacted in 2009, effective for SFIA payments in 2010. What was not contemplated at the time was that the class description, even though the class description seemed to be appropriate, the types of land included in 2C tended to be substantially higher in value than those that were included under the old 2B classification. The reason for this is that land is traditionally classified 2C provides for higher values because when you look at it from a property owner's perspective, the landowner benefits a great deal more from a reduced class rate if they have a higher valued land than they would from a fixed payment as in the SFIA. And the two are mutually exclusive. You cannot be in 2C and SFIA. So a savvy landowner who is knowledgeable of what would benefit the most would enroll their lands in 2C if they had a higher value, and they would enroll in the SFIA program with a lesser value. Both of them required, as I mentioned, a forest management plan, so both required some participation by the property owner. The department first realized there was a problem when we calculated the 2010 SFIA payments. The payment amount nearly doubled. It went from $8.74 in 2009 to $15.67 for payments made in 2010. When we went back and checked out the formula to see what had happened, we concluded the payments were increase was nearly entirely the result of the increase in value as a portion of that formula from the 2B land to going to the 2C land. The average value per acre was for the 2C land was $2,100, and the 2B land for that same year was $1,167. The result of this is that the SFI payment nearly doubled, as I said, and created the problems that we're addressing at this time.
Mr. Hagan, I've got a handout on its way. It's being copied, but I just want to repeat what you said, that the payment from 2010 to 2011 pretty much doubled from $8.74 to $15.67 per acre in error. That was a complete error, right?
Madam Chair, I believe what happened is we were trying to be proactive and anticipate concerns that might occur. I believe we're being proactive in looking at the 2B classification, recognizing it was greatly expanded. We looked for a landing place for these lands for that calculation, and we chose 2C as an appropriate landing place. Part of the problem was the 2C classification was newly created in 2008 also, and we didn't have a lot of historical data to determine what sort of lands would be enrolled in the 2C lands. Our best estimate at the time was that 2C, because of how much it mirrors the existing 2B class, would be a better measure for the SFIA calculation than the 2B class.
Well, just looking at your letter, Mr. Hagan, it says, third paragraph, our assumptions for the 2009 legislative change were incorrect.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Your assumptions for the 2009 legislative change were incorrect.
That
I just want to be clear for the record here. What, if anything, did the Department of Revenue do to fix this legislatively? Mr. Mossman?
Madam Chair and members, with regard to the legislation, obviously the department has considered a number of options for what would be a possible fix to this. There's nothing that's been proposed at this time, but I think there would be an openness to, as referenced in the letter, to making some adjustment to the program that clearly undoes this unintended consequence in terms of where the lands are pointed to, or in terms of the value of these lands in the State Forest Land Incentive Program.
Well, Mr. Mossman and maybe Commissioner Franz would like to answer the question, but the governor hasn't made any reductions in his proposal at all, not even $1 to this program. Is there some reason why this wasn't even considered when you looked at tax aids and credits, Commissioner?
Madam Chair and members, certainly one of the goals of the governor initially in starting off on looking at the whole problem of local government aids and dealing with that budget issue is the governor wanted to start off by making no changes to the local government aid programs or any cuts. This was obviously considered as an issue that needed to be addressed, and but at the time we felt that it wasn't the right time to do it. We're certainly willing to consider going forward with that. We understand that this committee has proposal. This both bills have proposals to modify the program, and we're not unopposed to that, but we're also willing to work with some other legislative potentials. We understand that there's a problem that needs to be addressed, we're willing to work on it, but we have no proposal at this time.
Commissioner, I have to wonder at how willing you were to look at reasonable reductions in our budget if you weren't willing to look at this obvious one that needed correction and needed reduction. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Hagan, just a couple questions then. The 2B land, if I understand it, is timber that's being harvested, right? So, somebody's making a profit off of the timber and also getting payments from the state? I don't quite understand.
Mr. Hagan.
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, the 2B land as it was prior to 2008 was for forest management or for timberlands that were used as part of a production, and people were harvesting the timber in conjunction with the 2B class. In 2008, the 2B class changed dramatically when it was renamed rural vacant land, and it encompassed basically all kinds of rural vacant lands that were no longer in production. So in some instances, there were people that were actually logging the property. But a component of the SFIE program is that it does not prohibit logging. What it requires is the effective management of the forest land so that you do harvest in an orderly and timely manner.
And Madam Chair and Mr. Hagan, I understand that there are private programs that these landowners can enroll in as well, and I just wonder if we're not duplicating. And it seems to me that this is not very needed in terms of people who have land, who care about the land, who are actually eligible to harvest it even. So can you comment, though, on private programs that might offer the same benefits?
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, I'm not personally familiar with private programs, and, of course, I'm not an expert in forestry. I'd be maybe better posed to the DNR officials. But our simple role is to administer the program, and as the laws are written, try to do our best to administer it.
Thanks.
Mr. Hagan, we're now handing out this copy of not just the revenue estimate, but also the sampling, the 2009 sampling that was done by the Department of Revenue. Do folks have this landscape chart and hand it out yet? Do you have this one, Adam? Okay. As soon as we can get that handed out, I know you've seen it, Mr. Hagan. Did you actually prepare that sampling?
Madam Chair, I did not prepare this. I'm not at all sure I've seen it, but it appears it was prepared by the research unit.
I want to make sure that folks have it before we talk about it. If you don't mind just waiting 1 second here.
Madam Chair, maybe just a question. The 2C, what is the rate then of the 2C property?
Madam Chair, Representative Runbeck, I may have missed that in my presentation. I apologize. The incentive for the 2C property is a 0.65 class rate, which is significantly less than the 1% class rate for the former 2B class or most other classes.
Okay, thanks.
Both of these handouts now in front of you?
I do, Madam Chair.
The first one is the what looks like the fixed payment amount. It says confidential at the top, and it shows the payment history per acre. So 2007, $524, all the way up to 2011, $15.67. It almost doubled in that 1 year. And it also shows that the current law payment rate is projected to exceed $16 per acre beginning in fiscal year 2012. I want to compare that to this sample sheet prepared by the research unit that sampled certain properties that benefited from this program. And you'll see in the bold at the bottom, it says $6.16 was the average property tax per acre in the sampling. So the actual liability for the property taxpayer was $6.16 per acre at the same time that the state of Minnesota was giving them a subsidy of $15.67 in error. Am I reading these documents right, Mr. Hagan?
Madam Chair, you are reading the documents correctly, I believe. The payment does exceed the tax amount. If I had been designing the program at the time, I would have certainly had tried to have some provision where the payment would be linked to the tax amount and not to an average tax amount throughout the state.
Well, and Mr. Hagan, many of these property owners who receive this benefit are out-of-state owners of Minnesota property, correct? So we're actually subsidizing folks that own property in Minnesota well beyond, more than double, what they actually pay in property taxes. We're just sending them money.
Madam Chair, in some cases that would be correct.
Oh, okay.
Other questions for Mr. or comments for Mr. Hagan? Representative Runbeck.
Madam Chair, I believe the House position zeroes out SFIA, and I don't know what your position is.
Representative Runbeck, it does the same thing.
Okay.
This is a troubled program. It's hard to justify what's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
There is also a lawsuit pending, as you're probably aware. And Mr. Hagan, I don't know if you want to comment about the lawsuit regarding the covenants.
Madam Chair, I believe I am prohibited from discussing the lawsuit, but if I'm mistaken, I would certainly, I believe our position is to not discuss the lawsuit.
Mr. Hagan, we can have counsel update members of the committee if they haven't already been. So there is counsel for the Department of Revenue that can update members if they need information about that pending lawsuit against the state. Other questions or comments from members about the SFIA program? Or comments from folks here who would like to testify about the SFIA program? All right, members, and I'd like to move on to Article 2, sales and use tax. In our binders, we have the same and similar. In particular, in Article 2, I guess it's going to be handed out. We've got them on page 6 in the side-by-side summary. You have this in front of you now. You'll recall that this is one of the few where we had exactly the same in not just the House, the Senate, but also in the governor's proposal. Article 2, Section 1 in the Senate and Article 2, Section 2 in the House both relate to ringtones. Representative Davids?
Madam Chair, I would move Article 2, Section 1 of the Senate position. That is the issue regarding ringtones. And it's the House, the Senate, and the governor's proposed budget.
Ms. Temple?
Madam Chair and members, just to point out, I just want to point out that provision is there is a fiscal impact for the exemption of ringtones. It's $410,000 in fiscal 12 and 13, and $390,000 in fiscal 14 and 15.
Thank you, Ms. Templin. Other questions or comments from members regarding Representative David's motion? Are there folks here that would like to testify? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, did I hear that right, that this is a fee that's going to be charged, but it actually costs money? Did I hear that correctly?
Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair, members, no, this is a sales tax exemption, so there's a revenue reduction.
I see. All right.
Senator Limmer, we're cutting taxes here.
This is
on ringtones. On ringtones. Further questions or comments about the ringtones provision in Article 2, Section 2 in the House and Article 2, Section 1 in the Senate bill? Representative David's motion is to accept the Senate language on that bill. Seeing none, all those in favor of Representative David's motion signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
I would like to move the House position to streamline sales tax language, Article 2, Sections 3, 4, 5, and 6. And just so everyone knows, this was in the House bill. It's the Department of Revenue provision, and it's also in the Senate. It was a Senator Chamberlain bill.
Senator Chamberlain, would you like to speak to this language?
No, Madam Chair.
Other questions or comments for Representative Davids regarding the motion or regarding the language being considered by the House and Senate Tax Conference Committee? Seeing none, all those in favor of Representative Davids' motion to adopt the House language in Article 2, Sales and Use Taxes, Sections 3 through 6. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
I would like to move regarding the vendor sales tax remittances. It repeals the 2010 changes on early remittance requirements. It's on page 6. So I would move the House position, Article 2, Sections 1 and 11, and it's the same as the language in the Senate of Senator Howe's bill.
Are there questions?
Madam Chair, could you just
Representative Runbeck.
Cite the section again?
Representative Davids.
Okay, it's Article 2, Section 1 and 11 on the House side.
Representative Runbeck, this has to do with the accelerated remittance schedules.
Yep. All right, thanks.
Other questions or comments regarding Representative Davids' motion to adopt the House language on Article 2, Sections 1 and 11. Are there folks here that would like to testify regarding these provisions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no. The motion is adopted.
Madam Chair.
Representative Davids.
Madam Chair. I would like to move Article 4, Section 2 regarding electric generating facility, the Senate provision, same as the House provision. It's on page 19, side by side. I believe this was a. We had. That's the governor. I'm sorry.
For the
Article 4 in the Senate, Article 5 in the House.
For folks here, we're on the property. We've moved to property taxes away from sales taxes, and we are on Article 4, Section 2 in the Senate position. And Mr. Patrick, what was the section in the House language? Do you know? It was in Article 5.
It's Article 5, Section 2.
Members, we are on page 19 of the side-by-side bill comparisons. And Senator Rosen, this is the electric generating facility for your community. Would you like to speak to the motion by Representative Davids?
Yes, Madam Chair, I thank you very much for this motion that has been approved by the city. It's moving forward, and they sold the land, and it's ready to go, so I'd appreciate this.
All right. Are there other folks that would like to testify here regarding Article 4, Section 2 of the Senate position, or in Article 5, the provisions regarding the electric generating facility? Seeing none, all those in favor of Representative David's motion on this issue signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. The amendment or the motion is adopted.
Madam Chair, we're on our way.
Representative Davids, we've made good progress today. We have other business. I'd like to take you back to the minerals article. We do have some other handouts for us, so forgive me. We're not going to move quite to the minerals article first. I've got a couple more handouts for folks. One of them is the Budget Trends Study Commission language from that report from January 12, 2009. And Commissioner Franz, I wanted to follow up on our conversation from earlier where we talked about stability. I think that you might want to reference back to the conversation we had about competitiveness. And your answer, and correct me if I'm wrong, was that the governor was concerned about stability in our tax system and that would help in terms of competitiveness. But maybe you want to restate your position on that competitiveness so we're all clear where you're at and the governor is at.
Madam Chair, well, thank you for the question. Clearly, one of the concerns the governor wanted to address was the ability of the state of Minnesota to provide a competitive business environment to encourage investments, to encourage businesses to operate within the state. And a lot of those provisions deal with the governor's proposal in terms of fairness and stability and competitiveness. In terms of the competitive aspect, there were several ways that the governor intended to increase the competitive opportunities in Minnesota. One of those was to reduce the pressure on increasing property taxes so that we would stop the growth on property tax for businesses. That was one of the reasons the governor recommended no cuts to LGA was to stop any increases on property taxes because, as we all know, property taxes are a large component of what businesses have to pay. But one of the other aspects of competitiveness that the governor wanted to several aspects. One of them was to try to broaden the corporate base so that more corporations pay their full share of corporate tax, so they're not special provisions. But also with respect to the in terms of the environment in Minnesota, to provide an opportunity so that as we structure a budget, we do so in a way that's balanced, that uses revenues and cost-cutting measures, so that the business climate in Minnesota is one where businesses can rely on the level of government services that will be here over the next few years. Businesses can rely on what the level of taxes will be. So the whole concept of competitiveness for the governor was to present and prepare a budget package that would foster stability and growth in Minnesota as we move forward.
Commissioner, I appreciate your restating the position. I wanted to bring it back up again because I wondered about the claim that somehow the governor is promoting stability with his tax proposal, and I would say to the contrary, Commissioner and Governor Dayton, the taxes that you're relying on will increase volatility in our system. The two that the governor and you have proposed in the governor's proposal rely on the corporate tax, which is the most volatile and regressive, and also the individual income tax, which is a very volatile tax. And the Department of Revenue Research Department has confirmed that it increases the volatility of our overall system if we were to adopt your proposal. So I question your commitment to stability. But it leads me back to the fact that it was simply a defense to our question about competitiveness. I asked you for evidence in your proposal that the governor ever considered competitiveness. And I was told, well, the governor was concerned about stability. And I'm wondering, how could he have been concerned about stability when he's proposing the most volatile taxes? So I'm still wondering, I think we're all wondering, where is the governor's commitment to competitiveness? Stability can be a good thing, but the governor's proposal doesn't really improve stability either. So I would ask the governor to go back and look again. It's pretty clear to me why House and Senate members have not supported the governor's proposal. It's because of these flaws in the thinking. We're very concerned about
competitiveness. The governor doesn't appear to be. We're very concerned about stability. The governor doesn't really appear to be. And if we keep raising taxes and keep raising tax aids and credits, we'll never accomplish either of those goals, stability or competitiveness. So I hope you'll take that message back to the governor, Commissioner Franz. I think you're on the wrong track, and I hope you'll take back this section of the Budget Trends Study Commission that does identify the volatility in the governor's proposal. Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair, thank you for those comments. I think one of the things that, as you talk about competitiveness, the governor is very, very concerned about that. And part of the reason for the balanced approach to resolving the budget crisis was to make sure that the services that are available, for example, some of the witnesses that we had testify last week talked about the concern over trained workforce. They talked about the concern over other issues that they have, to transportation issues. So, for example, the fellow from, I think, Brooklyn Park, who had the concern about the loss of jobs, the loss of trained workforce, because North Dakota was providing more job training for skilled workers. The governor's budget proposal is competitive in several ways, and one of them is to manage the cuts in a way that simply do not reduce the level of services that we provide for businesses. I think as we talk about small businesses, and we heard this time and time again, the number one concern for small businesses was the workforce. Where are we going to find workers? Where are we going to find trained people to provide the necessary jobs for the small businesses and for the large businesses? So the governor's balanced approach in both cutting the budget in a very sensitive way and also in providing new revenue provides the kind of economic stability that companies believe in. Companies look at a state and they look at whether the state is balancing its budget in a way that provides the level of services that its employees, its workforce can rely on going forward. And also the businesses look to the tax structure to make sure it's a structure that will not increase its burden. For example, both of these bills before this committee would increase property taxes for businesses overall. The governor's bill will hold the line on property taxes. So property taxes under the governor's bill will be less than both of these bills. That's a very important part of the competitive aspect of Minnesota. So the governor has used a balanced approach for his budget. He's used a balanced approach for revenues. And we believe both of those provide for competitive environments, Madam Chair.
Well, Commissioner Franz, did the governor cut any tax rates in his proposal?
Madam Chair, the governor provided for some business research and development credits that would give businesses an opportunity to engage in research and development activities.
Your answer would be to the question I asked, did the governor cut any tax rates in his proposal?
Madam Chair, the governor did not, and the governor believes that in this particular budget situation and this crisis, this is not the time to be cutting tax rates.
Well, Commissioner, with all due respect, the rates are not competitive. The rates that Minnesotans are paying compared to others across the country are not competitive. That's what we're trying to address here, and the governor isn't helping. And you can say that you're going to try and hold the line on property taxes, and you can say that you want to have a stable system, but it's unsustainable if you're going to increase spending 22%. That's unsustainable government spending, and that's not building a case for stability at all. I'd like to hand out a pie chart to folks that shows how Governor Dayton solves the $5.028 billion shortfall. And, Commissioner, you talked about managing the reductions, but the governor only reduces $261 million. That's 5% of our shortfall. I don't know how that's stable at all. In fact, you've proposed $3.1 billion in new taxes. Some of it is really questionable as to whether we'll actually see that revenue materialize. And then you've got the fact that you're spreading out even more tax increases to corporations and businesses, not just through the corporate income tax, but through the individual income tax. I think your argument has more than a few flaws. I hope you'll look at this. I'd say managing reductions 261 million towards a $5 billion deficit. I would say that you haven't accomplished a lot, with all due respect. Are there other members that would like to weigh in on this question of stability or competitiveness or volatility or how much we've cut versus how much we're spending in the governor's proposal? Senator Senjum?
Well, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just sitting here recalling a document that we talk about a lot, and that's, I believe, one put together by the Taxpayer Association. I don't have it right now, but I mean, we're, you know, Minnesota ranked 44 in the country in terms of a business climate. That's just not competitive. And we talk about stability, taking a tax rate at 7.85 and making it 10.95 or 13 point whatever it was going to be, that's not stability. That is not the way you're going to grow a business climate in Minnesota. And you know, we're just going to have to, in my view, you know, hang on to our seats, live within our means, and make this work. But we're not going to make prosperity work in Minnesota, you know, adding to the tax burden on our businesses. It's just counterintuitive. It's not going to work. We're told that it's not going to work time after time. Sooner or later, we just have to get it, accept it, and understand it.
Representative Runbeck, and then Representative Moon.
Thank you for your comments, Madam Chair. And I think the volatility point is an enormous one. And I do think that raising the top tier to 10.95% is really kind of wishful thinking. Those folks, you know, are pretty sophisticated in terms of investments that they make. And I think we learned here on Thursday that the folks with passive income are probably going to choose not to invest it in growing businesses. In fact, they're going to look for tax-sheltered kinds of investments. And the more that Minnesota appears to be going after those individuals and trying to, you know, grab some tax revenue, they are more likely to try to find ways not to pay taxes. I mean, they have that option. And so I think the governor's plan actually will see more of the rich pay fewer taxes. And I don't think that's at all the direction we want to be going. And it really then hurts hardest those individuals who are growing a business, who are plowing their resources back into making something happen with their capital, as opposed to having passive investments. So I think for two reasons, it just has plenty of holes in it, then we're going to regret, and we will not see these revenues materialize, I'm convinced.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, you and I have had some good conversations, and you know, I just have concerns about going in this direction with a fourth-tier bracket and a pretty significant jump in that bracket as well, when a lot of other states who are also grappling with their budget decisions are not moving in that direction. And it's really kind of placing Minnesota in a category far and away from other states for which it competes for business and for people to move here. And to come to our state. And there's many reasons to do that, but I'm just concerned that, you know, some of the proposals that other states have gone in this direction, they've then pulled back and realized either the revenue that they had hoped for didn't materialize or it caused other negative effects that wasn't having the desired result on their budget or their economy. So just a cautionary note there. That is something that concerns me a great deal.
Thank you, Representative Loon. Other questions? Or Representative Lanchesky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just would point out, you know, I think most folks know that I authored this bill to create this Budget Trend Study Commission. It was Senator Cohn and I, and I hope maybe in the next meeting we'll get the full report. And I understand you're trying to make a point on volatility, but the full report has a lot more going on as it relates to taxes than these two pages that have been extracted from the report. And I think we just need to think holistically about the whole thing. I think when I authored the Budget Trend Study Commission, a lot of people suspected the result of that would be that there would be a strong argument for raising taxes, and that was never my intent, and that's not the intent of the study, and that isn't what the study says. The study looked at the spending side and the tax side and the adequacy and the demographic shifts of the state. And so it is nice to talk in isolation about one piece, but, you know, I think we're all going to have to come together in 19 days. In 19 days, we're done. Is that we do need to cut more. I mean, government needs to get smaller. It's not sustainable. I think people are kidding themselves if they don't think that's the case. But we have to have adequate resources for the level of government we want. And I think that's where the dance is. I think to presume that, you know, one side or the other here is going to win, I think is false. I've never seen that happen since I've been here. So, I would only comment that we should maybe look at things in totality if we're going to talk about volatility. I mean, capital gains is far more volatile than the corporate tax. And that's the whole reason, really, that the February forecast improved over the November forecast was when Obama pursued the Bush tax cuts and they had agreement in federal conformity. The capital gains revenue that then came in was tremendous. So that's really the big bump Minnesota got, and then Governor Dayton dropped the surtax. I disagree with what he chose to do on that, but that is where the money came from. And so there's a lot of volatile pieces that we can discuss. I think, you know, we know that the overwhelming bulk of the state's revenue system is income and sales. I mean, you can have the corporate tax or get rid of it completely, and it's not going to move the meter very much in the whole $34 billion budget. So, you know, I think it's a difficult issue, and I think volatility has to be addressed. But I also think if we're just going to be for non-volatile taxes, then we should just move to a state property tax system, because that's the one that's not volatile. You pay it whether you're rich or poor. You pay it whether you have a job or not. You pay it whether your business is running or not. And so it is the tension in all these principles of adequacy and volatility and progressivity and regressivity and efficiency and transparency that we all have to weigh, and we all know that. But, you know, I'm getting concerned when the compromise is going to start, and you know, it's May 3rd, so, you know, I'm just here to push everybody, Commissioner Franz and Mr. Mossman, you know, to the governor and to all the conferees. It's time to start to negotiate, and you know, I guess one of the things I would ask you, Madam Chair, is, you know, I was thinking about drafting a motion today to bring to this group, and I knew it would fail, but, you know, just to start thinking about this, you know, the governor has said, at least what I've heard, you know, via letters, I mean, he hasn't said this to me, but, you know, I've just read it, heard it on the press, whatever, you know, that he's waiting for one honest, balanced budget from the majority. And his assessment, as I read it, is what Commissioner Showalter wrote to all of us in a letter. And remember, for the public, I mean, the commissioner I'm referencing was Governor Plenty's top numbers guy, and he's Governor Dayton's top number guy. So just for the public, this is a nonpartisan person who said that in the House budget, there's $1.2 billion missing. And in the Senate bill, I think it was a little less. And Governor Dayton said, you know, the negotiation starts when all the non-revenue or all the money that is not countable is out. And so that's not in these bills, Madam Chair. It's not in your bill, and it's not in Chair David's bill. But the problem is you're the revenue chairs, you too. And yet all these other chairs are carrying revenue, and they shouldn't be. And I was trying to think of how I could make a motion just to make the point, and instead of a motion, I'm just saying it, because I knew it would go down, is how do we move the finance chairs who are out there spending money that they can't count and they don't have back to this committee? And I think that's what the governor is saying. If we need revenue, because if you did this pie chart for the House and Senate bills, there's a bunch of revenue for the House and Senate bills too, but they're sitting in other committees. That's the concern. And so, you know, I'm just wondering your perspective as you go forward in the next 19 days, you know, how does the, or do you know, I mean, you certainly can't speak, I suppose, for Senator Koch directly, but do you know what the plan is for, and I've asked Chair Davids this in the House as well, so now I'm asking you, you know, what's the plan to get that money, you know, out of the bills so that the negotiation can start and so that the real revenue debate can happen here? I mean, we have three chairs in the House who are carrying major revenue, and they're not Chair Davids. And so I just wonder your thoughts on you know, how do we spend the next 19 days getting where we need to go?
Well, Representative Lunchesky, You've said so much there, honestly, and that was more than one question and certainly more than one topic. But let me start at the beginning. I agree with you that volatility may be a distraction at this point. I would say it is a distraction in that we want to talk about competitiveness. And the governor says, well, what about stability? And I said, well, wait a minute. There's no stability. It's volatile. Your proposal is volatile. So it's not competitive, and it's not stable. And so we're saying competitiveness comes first. We have to grow the economy. And we can't do that by imposing new taxes. And the governor needs to hear that. He wants a different set of bills. That's very nice. But this is the Senate position and a House position that we are not going to raise taxes to balance the budget. The House voted, the Senate voted. So we're working out the differences between our bills, but that's common between the two bills. And that is the proposal that the governor has to deal with, and he can't just sit back and say, well, I wish I had a different proposal. We have a Senate position, and we have a House position. I respect yours. Hopefully you'll respect our Senate position, and we're going to move forward, and we're going to conferee this bill. I don't speak for Representative or for Senator Koch or the leadership team about how the negotiations are going with the governor or about the other chair's bills. We've got work before us still to negotiate between the House and the Senate. We're going to do that, and I am not sure I hit all of your topics, but I think I've come close. I don't want this committee to be distracted by arguments about volatility and stability. Our clear focus is competitiveness, and it should be, because that's the only way Minnesota is going to get healthier economically, is if we start to address the fact that we have more government than we can afford, and we have to downsize the state's government and primarily live within our means. We have plenty of resources, Representative Lencheski. You and I may disagree on that. But I think Minnesotans pay enough in taxes. They pay enough to the state. And we've got work to do in this committee to resolve the tax aids and credits and other provisions. Other questions or comments about those issues? Otherwise, we can move on to the minerals article. And, Senator Senjum.
Madam Chair, it's hard to let this one go, but And we were all back home, if you will, a week or so ago. We can talk about the rates, and we can talk about all of this. But what I found out is, and if I didn't know it already, is the mere mention of a 10.95% increase in terms of income tax rate, even if that never happens, it's chilling. It affects people's attitude with respect to business investment. And I think that's hurting us right now. And to the point, and if we can do it, if we can simply come off that mantra and get back to reality and where we ought to be, I'm not sure if we can take that back. But at least where I live and talking to the people I talk to, the idea that income tax rates may be increasing literally 3% is chilling, and it stalls, if you will, any notion of business growth or investment. And so I think that's serious as well.
Thank you, Senator Senjum. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Were we going to come back to property tax aids? Okay.
We will. I had told folks we would get to the minerals article today, and because we have to be done at 10:15, I do want to turn to that next. And then we have a lot of folks that at some point will want to testify about the tax aids and credits, and we're going to take some time on that. So if with the indulgence of the committee, I'd like to move on to the minerals article and have an overview from Ms. Zoff regarding the differences between the House, Senate, and Governor's provisions on the minerals article.
Madam Chair, members, the minerals article provisions, I'm going to be working off the side-by-side summary, and that begins at the bottom of page 28 of that side-by-side. And
Ms. Zoff, Mr. Michael is here as well, and he may have some comments as well to help us out.
Sure. Thank you. Starting on Section 1 of Article 6 of the Senate bill, there are a series of provisions in the Senate article that deal with the application of the law to what is hoped to be the emerging non-ferrous mining industry. Currently, no one is
engaged in this occupation in the state, but there have been attempts over the years to modify the provisions of the existing occupation tax and net proceeds tax that would apply to non-ferrous mining and refining activities. So a number of the provisions in the Senate article relate to that attempt. Beginning with Section 1, it clarifies that businesses that conduct mining, producing, or refining of ores, as well as metals and minerals, are exempt from the corporate income tax, which would be the same treatment as applies to the taconite activities, which are subject to a separate occupation tax as well. Section 2 of the Senate article is a sales tax exemption under current law. There is a sales tax exemption provided for materials that are substantially consumed in the production of taconite. This section would extend that same kind of sales tax exemption to the similar types of materials that are used in the processing of non-ferrous minerals or metals. Section 3 on the Senate side provides a definition of refining in the minerals taxation chapter, again related to that non-ferrous application of the law. The House provides a reduction in the rate of the occupation tax on non-ferrous minerals, and that would be other than iron ore or taconite, and that's reduced from 2.45% to 1.75%. The Senate bill does not reduce the occupation tax on the non-ferrous minerals. In that section, we do, again, add a reference to the metals or minerals to the description of the taxpayers who would be subject to the non-ferrous occupation tax. Section 5 of the Senate bill modifies the definition of gross income that's used in the non-ferrous occupation tax provision. And these provisions are not included within the House minerals article. Section 6 of the Senate article reduces the rate of the taconite occupation tax from the current rate of 2.45% to a rate of 0.06% over a period of 11 years. And that's not included in the House article. The House, on the other hand, increases the rate of the net proceeds tax on non-ferrous minerals from the current 2% to 2.7%. And then when that's combined with the change in the rate in Section 1 of the House provision, that maintains a consistent combined occupation and net proceeds tax rate of 4.45%. The Senate article does not change that rate. Let's see. In the House provision, the bottom of page 29 on the side-by-side, there's a section that modifies the distribution of the net proceeds tax on the non-ferrous minerals. The Senate article does not change that distribution, does not address it. Section 8 of the Senate article provides that the same deductions that would apply to the net proceeds tax for non-ferrous would be the same as those that are used in the computation of the occupation tax. And this would provide that deductions for depletion and interest expenses would be allowable for that purpose. Section 9 is another modification of a definition to include metals or mineral products that are subject to the non-ferrous net proceeds tax. Section 10 on the Senate side begins a series of changes to the rate of the taconite production tax, that current tax, and also to the means of distribution of the proceeds of that tax. In Section 10, there's a reference to the distribution to the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools, and that is stricken because that distribution is repealed later in the article. Section 11 modifies the current rate of the taconite production tax in two ways. First, it eliminates the implicit price deflator that applies to the rate so that the rate would be increased with the rate of inflation. This would be effective for production in 2011, taxes payable in 2012. And then the rate is reduced. In addition to the elimination of the implicit price deflator, the rate is also reduced from its current positions to accommodate the elimination of distributions to the Taconite Economic Development Fund, the Range Association, municipalities, and schools, and then also the distribution to the City of Eveleth that was for use in the Hockey Hall of Fame is stricken, although that would have been eliminated under current law as well. And the House bill does not modify the taconite production tax rate. Sections 12 through 17 are on the Senate side are modifications of the distribution of the taconite production tax. In several the intention of these changes is twofold. One is to eliminate the distributions that I mentioned earlier to the Taconite Economic Development Fund and to the Range Association, municipalities and schools, and to the City of Eveleth for the Hockey Hall of Fame. But then also there were modifications that were required to accommodate the fact that the Senate bill eliminates the escalator, because some of these distributions referred to increases that were attributable to the escalator. And again, the House does not, the only modification on the House side is the elimination under Section 4 of their article, the elimination of the escalator for the 3 cent per ton distribution to towns in the taconite tax relief area. On the repealer on the Senate side, paragraph A repeals the distributions that I mentioned earlier. Paragraph B repeals a provision that appropriates a state aid amount that would be equal to a tax of 22 cents per ton. That had that amount that was a general fund distribution had been added into the production tax distribution formula as and would have been distributed as if it were production tax proceeds. And then paragraph C is a repealer of a provision that had established separate deductions for the computation of the non-ferrous net proceeds tax. And that's the article, Madam Chair.
We have Mr. Ahern who would like to testify today, and we also have Commissioner Sertich, but first we'd like to take Mr. Ahern. Following those two gentlemen, we'll have Mr. Ungaro. Here he is. Mr. Ahern, welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Ahern, but with me is my better-looking twin, Frank Ungaro.
Morning, Madam Chair. Frank Ungaro, Executive Director of Mining Minnesota. We represent the 10 companies that have a presence in Minnesota, currently undertaking exploration and mineral development for non-ferrous copper, nickel, and precious metal mining in the state of Minnesota. And we're here this morning to support the non-ferrous language included in the Senate language of the omnibus tax bill. The Senate tax bill contains some very important clarifications to the tax law, which will apply to the still-developing non-ferrous industry. As the state of Minnesota wrestles with its budget deficit, there's one industry that stands poised to provide significant job growth in the state of Minnesota, second to none, and that's non-ferrous mineral development in Minnesota. The investors that look at investing hundreds and even billions of dollars in the state of Minnesota see as a main concern certainty and clarity. And certainty and clarity in the tax provisions in the state of Minnesota is certainly one of those issues. The provisions contained in the Senate language of the omnibus tax bill contain the clarification and provide the certainty and stability for that investment in the state of Minnesota. A little background and a couple basic objectives of the provisions I think are in order. The language adopted in the 80s set up the net proceeds tax structure Since then, in discussions with the Department of Revenue over the years, there have been some inconsistencies and questions about how this would be applied, keeping in mind it's never been applied to any company because we do not have any non-ferrous mining in operation yet in the state of Minnesota. And these provisions were developed in 2002, 2003 to add that clarity. Both the House and Senate in 2003 passed all of these provisions, and as a result of some disagreement in distribution of revenue, that minerals article and those provisions did not get adopted. The proposed amendments have two basic objectives. They define and include refining as part of the business of mining and subject that to the net proceeds tax. This clarification enables, encourages the tax and development of value-added products in Minnesota and on the Iron Range in northeastern Minnesota. The amendments also provide non-ferrous mining treatment comparable to taconite. They clarify and extend the sales tax exemption for expendable materials similar to taconite operations. In fact, a perfect example is the expendable materials that were used in the LTV facility when it was a taconite facility were exempt from sales taxes. The same facility is now owned by Polymet Mining. They will use the exact same equipment, but because the law does not provide for that exemption for non-ferrous, it would not be. Those consumables would not be exempt from sales tax. This would clarify that provision. Also, providing the same business deductions to the net proceeds tax as afforded to the occupation tax for taconite, for non-ferrous, and for the corporate franchise tax that all other businesses pay will be an important clarification, an important positive message sent to investors willing to look at investing in mining throughout the state of Minnesota. Madam Chair, with that, again, we support the language in the Senate tax bill as it pertains to non-ferrous mining. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ongaro. Mr. Ahern?
Mr. Chair, members of the Conference Committee, there is one little change that did not get, that was adopted by the Senate committee when they were reviewing this issue that didn't get into the Senate language, and that was some language that makes clear that the net proceeds tax is in lieu of the ad valorem tax. We believe, and I think the staff has got the language to accomplish that, but that's the to fail to clarify that issue could and would subject the non-ferrous industry to three taxes, ad valorem, net proceeds, and occupation tax. And I don't believe that that's been the intent of this body over the years that when they've had a chance to look at this issue. So that's the one final issue that I think remains to be clarified here.
Thank you, Mr. Ahern. Questions from conferees for Mr. Ongaro or Mr. Ahern?
Mr. Chair.
What's the run back?
Sounds to me like a green light for a number of the provisions in the Senate bill, and I'm just wondering if we can offer move some of the sections.
Could you repeat that for some reason?
Well, I'm just, hearing the testimony, and there's some, work has been done, I guess, over the years. So Section 1, 2, and 3, and certainly 8, 9, 10, and 11, are established some law pertaining to this whole industry, and it doesn't seem to conflict with anything the House has done. And I'm wondering if it's okay to move those.
I would just assume we didn't. At this point, Senator Ortman will be back here in a little bit. I don't think we're prepared to move any other language today. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was looking at that too. There's a cost on the Senate side of the spreadsheet in the out years. So, I was wondering when I came in, the ringtones were being moved, and that's a money item. Is there a target for this committee now that money items are being adopted?
There's not a target at this point,
okay.
But I think we can handle $400,000.
Really?
No, now, if we do that third tax on the minerals, maybe the budget numbers will look a little better.
Well,
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, I did have a question for Mr. Ungaro.
Okay.
Is there anything in, and I will just say I'm not a fan of non-ferrous, but that's neither here nor there on the tax piece, so I wouldn't be supporting it because I don't support non-ferrous mining. But on the tax piece, is this part of the mining industry asking for any other tax treatment? You know, I was reading your handout on whatever it said, expendable rods and balls, and I don't want to know what that is. I just, you know, some capital equipment, I'm sure. So are there any tax subsidies here? Because this is a business subsidy when these taxes are, when you're asking not to pay them, and they're ones that we've been giving to other parts of mining in the state of Minnesota. Are there any tax subsidy, tax cut requests, tax exemption requests that are not afforded to the rest of the mining industry? I mean, I can't, it seems like there isn't, but I'm just asking you if there is something new.
Madam Chair, Representative, there is nothing in addition to what is afforded the existing taconite industry that the non-ferrous industry is requesting, and there should be, to go to your the previous discussion, no fiscal impact related to the non-ferrous provisions in the Senate provisions of the omnibus tax bill.
Mr. 985. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Mr.
Or Madam Chair, Representative Lincheski, there is an advantage that value-added taconite operations have under current law, which is not being requested here, and that is a five-year phase-in for the production tax, and that is not something that this value-added industry is seeking.
Ms. Von Mosch, there you are. Can you speak to the proposal from the Senate?
Madam Chair, the items that are costed out on the spreadsheet for the tax provisions in the Senate are listed on page 3, line 84, and it is the taconite occupation tax rate reduction, which reduces the rate from 2.45% to 0.6% over a period of 11 years. These are just the items on the spreadsheet are just the general fund items. And then the other item that is in the tax bill that is also on the spreadsheet for the minerals item on the Senate side, I should also say that on line 83 is the House provision that relates to the non-ferrous occupation tax changes that are made in the House bill, and that has a negligible impact. On the Senate side, staying on line 84, the effective date for that provision is tax year 2014, which makes the first cost for the changes in the taconite occupation tax at $1,350,000 for fiscal year 15. Then the next item that has a general fund impact is the Senate's provision to eliminate the general fund payment of the 2 cents per ton for the taconite state aid or taconite relief program. That is listed on page 7. This is listed under the category of aids and credits, and it's listed on page 7, line 79. And that is a cost reduction or a savings of $14.1 million in fiscal years 12 and 13 and $17 million in fiscal years 14 and 15. At this point, we do not have any estimates on the items that are related to non-property or non-general fund items in the bill, and we don't have an estimate for the sales tax exemption for the the equipment that would be extended to non-ferrous. And I need to talk with Dr. Paul Wilson in revenue. We had a conversation about this earlier in the year, and I'm trying to remember that conversation right now. And I believe that they were viewing this as an extension of an existing exemption, but I need to clarify that and get back to committee members with a more clear answer on that.
Thank you so much. Other questions about the Senate's position or for Mr. Ahern or Ungaro? We also have Commissioner Sertich here who would like to testify regarding...
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Members, you have a letter from Commissioner Sertich that's been handed out, dated May 2. Commissioner Sertich, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and I'm here to talk not about the non-ferrous portion, but about other sections of the tax bill. And members, you should have all received this in your email as well, this letter from me. My name is Tony Sertich. I'm the Commissioner of the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, and this is my first opportunity to be before either tax committee. So just in brief introduction, the IRRRB is a unique state agency. In northeastern Minnesota, we serve parts of 7 counties, 15 school districts, about 140 communities in northeastern Minnesota. And I always get the question, we're generally under the Jobs Committee area, but the reason we're here is because our funding comes primarily from production taxes that are paid in lieu of property taxes. And I always get the question in the Jobs Committee is, why is northeastern Minnesota have a state agency when no other section of the state does? And the reason being is because of the area we serve, the Taconite Assistance Area, as I talked about, the parts of 7 counties, the 140 communities, the 15 school districts, that's where mining has traditionally taken place. And mining companies do not pay a property tax. They pay a production tax in lieu of property taxes. And the most efficient way to collect this tax across these 7 counties, 140 communities, and about 15 school districts, the most efficient way to collect that production tax instead of property taxes is through the State Department of Revenue, and then distribute it in a formula. And that formula is what you all decide in the tax committee. And that formula traditionally first pays out to the counties and the schools and the cities in lieu of property taxes, so they get their payments to their local communities. The remainder of that comes to this agency, which was established 70 years ago by Governor Harold Stassen in the legislature back in 1941, with the idea that this is the only non-renewable resource that is being produced in Minnesota. And those jobs will eventually go away as the resource either depletes or is not economically feasible to mine anymore. And so the mission of this agency is to diversify the economy away from iron ore or taconite mining into value-added non-ferrous and other industries beyond mining. And so that is the charge of this agency, and that is my charge, along with the 13-member advisory board, which is comprised of 5 state senators, 5 members of the House of Representatives, and 3 citizens, one appointed by the Senate, the House, and the governor. My concerns primarily in House File 42 are on the Senate side, and it deals with the distribution and the lowering of the production tax and its impact on my agency's ability to create jobs in Minnesota. And we have actually a fairly good track record of job creation at our agency. Just look back over the past 5 years, and members remember this is during a very rough economic time in our state, nation, and world. We have partnered with businesses, over 162 businesses in northeastern Minnesota, creating 1,223 jobs, retaining 525 additional jobs. The distribution and the cut in the production tax is going to negatively impact our ability to create jobs in the future. The Senate proposal actually reduces the production tax that mining companies are paying, and that will have an impact in our economic development funds at our agency. What also will impact us is taking off the escalator that is generally put in place. And as I said before, mining companies don't pay a property tax, and so therefore this escalator was put into effect to mirror what property taxes would be for production. And members, I just want to point out, this is at a time now when mining is at a high. Now, back in 2009, there was a moment where there was no production going on in northeastern Minnesota. Every mine was shut down at the exact same time, massive layoffs. But right now, and I was just at a conference in Duluth getting an update from every mining general manager in Minnesota, every mine is running at almost full capacity, full production. Mining companies are paying, are making record profits. And the value of taconite, the value of taconite is at historic levels. I fear that this proposal to lower the tax actually just makes the mining companies more profitable outside the region, but the value of this taconite, the state of Minnesota, the IRRRB, is not recognizing the value if we're lowering the tax at the very same time that the value and the production is at its highest level. And so that will impact our ability and the economic funds of our region. And so the freezing of the escalator, the take, not even freezing, but taking it off at a time, at this time, is, I believe, the wrong policy. We have frozen the escalator as a state in times past, but generally that has been at times when the industry was hurting, when mining production was down and we were trying to incentivize more mining. Well, the mines cannot produce any more taconite than they can today. They are running at full bore. So I do not see there any incentive to lower the tax rate now. There will only be a disincentive for us to partner with other private businesses to create jobs in Minnesota. And so with that, Madam Chair and members, I'm happy to answer any questions. I'm happy to come back anytime. I'm the only state agency located in rural Minnesota. So if you need me, my office is 3 hours north of here. So if you need me to come back at any time, I'm willing. I just need a three-hour heads up to jump in the car and drive down from northern Minnesota, where the snow has melted and our golf courses are opening soon. Well, I knew I would get the other chair's attention with that comment.
Well, Commissioner, you've said an awful lot, and I want to speak about the Senate's position on a couple of those points. And in particular, let's talk a little bit about the inflationary aspect or the escalator in the tax. The Taxpayers Association has been critical of the legislature for adopting an automatic increase in taxes that we don't review as policymakers. And local elected officials make those decisions on a regular basis. They don't just set into law automatic inflations and tax rates. And so it's not good policy. So do you want to address that point first? Because our Senate position follows the Taxpayers Association recommendation that we have oversight, direct oversight, over those tax rates.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, and you still do have oversight year to year, as I said. The escalator has been frozen in times, and I see it as a better policy for the state. The value, this would really be the only property taxes that would be frozen in state law. If you switch this to actually having to increase it or to take off or to put in the escalator to unfreeze it every 2 years. You still have the ability, if you wanted to this year, Madam Chair, members, to freeze the escalator as we have in years past. And so I just see it as the reverse of that. I see this as a better policy. Mining companies don't pay on levies, operational levies for school districts and others. So it's unique and different. So I think looking at it as apples to apples with any other local elected official looking at property taxes is different. It's a unique industry, and it's a non-renewable resource. And so I believe in the existing law where it says you still have the ability as the legislature to review this every year, and I think that the default position of having the ability to freeze it is a better position than what's in the Senate bill.
Commissioner, I appreciate that, but from a different point of view, not coming from your area, it seems to me that we don't automatically We look at our tax rates, I mean, locally, and I think that we as the policy makers for that community and those property taxes have a responsibility to the community as well to make sure that we look at them every year.
Yeah. And Madam Chair and members, the issue being somebody will pay that tax, and if it's frozen at the state level, if there is no escalator at the state level, this is one of the only areas, if there is no changes to tax policy, they stay as is, that burden will fall to the homeowners and other small businesses in northeastern Minnesota. And so it just, I think, there's a balloon there, and it just puts the pressure. If it's frozen on the mining companies and they're not paying into local property taxes, that burden falls to those local elected officials, but primarily falls on local small businesses and property taxpayers. And so that's where I see this escalator being an important public policy to actually help the other businesses in northeastern Minnesota and the other property taxpayers.
Mr. Dicklich, you seem like you need to step in here. So you need to say something here?
Yeah, Madam
like
Chair,
need to
if I may. And Commissioner Surich asked I come today because these provisions do impact the city's school districts and townships who are members of my organization, the Range Association of Municipalities and Schools. And I've been before the Senate Tax Committee before, but not before the House Tax Committee. And the history of the inflator came back in 1985 when we lowered the property tax or the taconite taxes about 20 cents at that time because the industry was going through very difficult times in this country and worldwide. And the implicit price deflator was brought to us by the industry. And what we were trying to do is to copy what happens with everybody else's property tax. The value of properties rise. And what the taconite tax would be static and could only be raised if you did it legislatively, which is what you're trying to do now. However, the industry even at that time thought that was a fair way to go about this. And since 1985, about half the time, the legislature has frozen that when the industry, the steel industry, is experiencing a lot of pressure from outside sources, mostly foreign steel. So if you go back and look at that tax, and roughly in 1990, the tax was $1.90, and taconite sold for $40 a ton back then. Right now, taconite in the past months has sold for $200 a ton, and the tax was $2.38. And so if you look at that time period and the amount and then take what the values of other private properties have taken over those years, I think that the taconite tax has stayed well within the bounds of reasonable property tax against that, especially now that it's almost $200 a ton and they paid $2.38, and when it was $40 a ton, they paid $1.90. And I may be off a few cents here and there, but that's basically when we put this in back in 1985, that's what we were trying to do, have a growth in property values for the taconite tax that would emulate or to copy what was happening with other people's private property tax. And then when times were tough, we'd come in, and after my time, others would come in and would freeze that tax together with the industry. I mean, we've been at a partnership with that industry since 1985 and haven't been at each other for a long, long time because that's our main industry. It funds the agency. It funds our cities, our school districts, and townships, and we need the industry, and they need us. So, and that's one of the reasons that inflator was there. And it was a formula that they brought to us as fair.
Members, Senator Rosen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Hi, Commissioner Surich. Nice to see you. Do we have a breakdown on what the property taxes are up in that Iron Range and those in the Summit County area, how they compare with the statewide? Have we seen any figures on that? And I have another question for you, too, but Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, that is out of the bounds of my committee. I think that's a better question left to the Department of Revenue. My agency does not deal with the taconite tax until we get to the remainder part. The cities, the schools, and all of that is taken care of before my agency gets involved. So that's a better question to the Department of Revenue.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Rosen.
That would be interesting to see how the property taxes are comparing to the other areas throughout the state. And my other question then, Commissioner, is the economic development program you have with the IIIRB and the dollars, what form is that? How are those jobs created? What is the economic program that you have in place, and how is it incentivized?
Sure. Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, thank you for the question. Our mission at our agency is really threefold. It's to look at business development, community development, and workforce development in a regional way. And I always say we've been doing regionalism long before it was cool and a buzzword down here at the Capitol for 7 years, like I said. And so when we look at businesses, we actually are very flexible with how we can help out. We do everything from helping with loan guarantees to direct loans to businesses to grants. We've helped out large businesses like Blue Cross and Blue Shield, Delta Dental, Delta Airlines create literally hundreds of jobs in northern Minnesota. were in support of PolyMet and some of the value-added in Esser Steel and some of the value-added mining ventures, but we also help out small businesses. As a matter of fact, at our last board meeting last month, we instituted a loan guarantee program to help out our small businesses, partnering with our community banks. It's something, actually, that legislators are looking to propose on a state level as well, where we're coming in to say that we'll guarantee up to 75% of a $100,000 loan for a small business that's going to create jobs within our service area. And so we're very flexible in how we can help out businesses. We take equity in businesses at times, and that's been actually beneficial to both the projects and payoff back to the region in a revolving loan format. We help out communities as well with infrastructure. As I said, if mining companies don't pay property taxes, these communities, when it's a very large industry, one of the largest industries in our region of the state, we help out with infrastructure, water and sewer and the like for our local communities as well to make sure that they have the ability to attract businesses, they have the streets and the sewers and everything else that's ready to go. And then we've helped with workforce development. So it really runs the gamut. As I said, helping out just in the past 5 years, partnering with 162 private businesses to create well over 1,200 jobs, retain 500 more jobs at a time when the economy was in rough shape. And while I have this opportunity, just to look at the dollar figures, our annual agency budget, and we budget annually because of the production tax. It's a very volatile tax. When you're talking about volatility, there's nothing more volatile than the production tax. As I can tell you, it's based on production. Production was running at about 40 million tons, and back in 2009, it dipped to 17 million tons of production. And so that significantly impacts our agency's budget. And so the proposal before you right now, its impact of lowering the taconite production tax at a time when there are record profits, record production, and record value, the proposal to lower the tax would have an impact on our agency of about $20 million for the next biennium. Now, this is in addition to what's happening in a different committee, in a different silo. There's a proposal to take another $45 or $60 million out of the DJJ corpus. And our annual budget of our agency is somewhere between $25 and $30 million. And so this would be a very significant cut to our agency and our ability to partner with hundreds of other businesses to create thousands of other jobs for Minnesota to help out.
Mr. Dinklish?
Madam Chair, if I can on that point as well, and by cutting that 34 cents or whatever, that takes that amount times the 40 million tons, it takes the out of the region, out of Minnesota, and just goes back to Cleveland and Pittsburgh. So you talk about economic growth and economic impact. I don't see how that would help that by taking and sending it to other states.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I presume it's the Department of Revenue that actually monitors these corporations and the tonnage and then assesses the tax. Is that where...
Madam Chair and Representative Runbeck, that is correct. Department of Revenue does all the administration.
Okay. I wonder if we could see, I mean, given that, business is good right now and the tonnages are increasing, could we maybe get a handle, show maybe from the Department of Revenue the previous 5 years of what the tax has generated under the current rate, and then I'll look at the next 5 years, current rate versus this reduced rate. Because if the tonnages are increasing, I think it's worthy of looking at how much revenue is really needed to be spun off.
Representative Runbeck, that was exactly the Senate's position, which was this 22 cents matching out of the general fund was instituted in 2001 when production was low. And now production is high, and that 22 cents subsidy from the general fund doesn't seem to have as much justification as it once did. And I understand about wanting to maintain certain levels and not respond to volatility and keep those funds steady, but the state has a crisis. I mean, we don't have funds in our general fund to provide that subsidy right now. And Commissioner Sertich, I wanted to ask you about where you got the $20 million that you talked about before, because our estimates show $14 million in reductions with that 22-cent general fund match. And I'm informed by Representative Davids that the information you're looking for, Representative Runbeck, is available, and folks will hand that out before our next meeting. Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and there's a few points to get at here. The first point is you can definitely go back. Department of Revenue has a mining tax guide that it distributes every year, and there's a lot of information in there. And just to make mention, mining companies don't just pay taxes to northeastern Minnesota. They pay occupation taxes, sales taxes, you name it, to the state as well. To project 5 years into the future is the difficult thing to do, because that would be able to project what the tonnage of production could or would be. And as I've said, it's anywhere from 40 million tons to 17 million tons. It's really dependent upon the demand for steel. And so that's difficult to get at. But the other piece of why the 22 cents was there, general fund tax dollars, it wasn't just because LTV shut down for subsidy's sake. It was also at the same time, if members would recall, and I think Chair Davids would recall back in 2001, this is when there was a buy down of state business taxes across the state as well, right around that same time. And mining companies don't pay a business tax. And so part of the reason that they were a piece of this is to recognize that there should be a business tax cut for the mining companies. And the only way to do that is to not lower business taxes, as was done, as was bought down that year for every other business. The only way to impact the mining industry was through this formula to buy down. And at the same time, we actually increased their rebate program, and they get a rebate of taxes if they invest in Minnesota. And so the rationale was not just because of the downturn, Madam Chair, as you said, that was a portion of it when LTV shut down, 1,400 jobs were lost in the state, but it was also because other businesses were getting tax relief from the state of Minnesota, and the only way to provide that same tax relief to the mining industry was through this formula. And to answer the other question, Madam Chair, how I'm getting to the almost $20 million is if I look at, and I got these numbers from the Department of Revenue, and I'd be happy to share the format that I'm looking at it in, is with a reduction in the tax rate from the $2 and almost 40 cents to $2.07, that would eliminate the Taconite Economic Development Fund, and that would the 22 cents would be reduced. That in the fiscal year 13 budget would be a $16.675 million reduction. But at the same time, because the taconite payments are paid twice a year, and if you take the state aid right now, that would be an additional reduction, and we'd actually have to pay it back because we already got have already received the first payment from the taconite companies. We would have to pay back an additional $3.3 million with this reduction of state aid. And so when you lower the tax, that's different than getting rid of the state aid, and you're doing both in your proposal. And so by lowering the tax, that's over $16 million reduction to our agency over the biennium. To get rid of the state aid, that's an additional $3 million reduction to the agency, and that's where we get to almost $20 million. And I'm just going off the information I received from the Department of Revenue on that.
Clarifying. One other provision that you testified about, Commissioner, is the Economic Development Fund, the 30.1 cents. Maybe you didn't testify about that, but I would appreciate your testimony on that, where that tax is directed to your funds, and then you authorize a rebate back. Why isn't that just a government intrusion and distortion of the way that these businesses might otherwise invest their funds? Why do we need the IRRB to weigh in to decide what is good investment on the part of these companies?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this, what you're talking about, is the Taconite Development Fund. And this was instituted back in 1992, and the rate at that time was about 10 cents per ton. It's up around 30 cents right now. This actually, I think, addresses two issues. It incentivizes a reinvestment back into Minnesota, and that's the reason that this fund was originally adopted, was in cutting taxes of a business that is located outside the state of Minnesota, there is no incentive to reinvest in Minnesota, especially in rough economic times. They can go overseas to get this natural resource. The incentive, though, is to say we are going to incent if you reinvest in your taconite plants here in Minnesota. That's job creation for Minnesota in the short term in construction, in the long term in making sure we have a viable taconite industry. And so that's why this rebate program was adopted. Having the oversight of the agency and the legislators that sit on the IRRB was a way, once again, to make sure that they're actually investing this money in Minnesota and not rebating it just back out east or outside of the state.
Well, Commissioner, that may go well up in your area, but
for me, I'm a free market person, and I think that these investors should be able to invest as they see fit without government control over their investments. I'm not sure why the market, if it's a good market, won't encourage reinvestment in the community. Commissioner?
Well, Madam Chair, it may encourage investment with this company, but it may encourage the investment in Brazil or Chile or somewhere else other than Minnesota. And so this is all about Minnesota jobs.
Well, Commissioner, then would you say that Mayo should be subject to the same restrictions or any other Minnesota company? Why is this okay in your area but would never be acceptable in Rochester or Chanhassen or Maple Grove or Minneapolis? Why is this okay?
Madam Chair and members, we're talking here about a very unique agency, and I don't want to look at it as just my region. It is a part of the entire state of Minnesota, and you, Madam Chair, and the state benefits from having a thriving mining industry. The reason is you're mining a non-renewable resource. They can only get it in northeastern Minnesota in the state. That's why it's not Rochester. Rochester doesn't have taconite. Eden Prairie doesn't have taconite. Wilmer doesn't have taconite. We have this non-renewable resource that you can only tax once, and then it's gone forever and leaves a hole in the ground. And it's not a matter of Rochester versus Hibbing versus the range, you name it. It's a matter of we're competing with other countries in the world. And if we go just by free market, they can go to other places, third world countries, where they don't have the environmental restrictions, where they don't have the livable wages, and they can mine it there, or they can mine it here in the United States and in Minnesota. And I believe it's good policy for us to incentivize those jobs in Minnesota, in the United States, and not other parts of the world, because that's where the mining takes place if it doesn't take place here.
Well, Commissioner, I understand the argument that and the treatment that this is taking value out of the property and that we are trying to substitute for a property tax base. I understand that. But then this control, in addition to that special treatment, seems to be very heavy-handed. Mr. Dicklich.
Madam Chair, just historically again, this provision was brought to us back in 1991 by the mine managers in an attempt to force their companies to invest back in Minnesota. The industry was in a little bit of problems. We'd already frozen the tax, and this was their way of getting their companies some leverage to put money back in the plants here so that these plants would stay viable. And that's the history of it. It was brought to us by the industry.
Well, for members, I'd like to point out that these recommendations that are included in the Senate position were recommendations that were made by the Minnesota Taxpayers Association in 2004. They weren't generated out of nowhere to try and hurt folks up in northern Minnesota, but as measures of good policy. Good tax policy, in my view, wouldn't include the heavy-handed control over the reinvestments in your community in addition to the property tax treatment. I think we've gone overboard here. And the general fund subsidy, I just don't think we can afford it. So I think there are common sense provisions in the Senate, but I know you all disagree with that. I appreciate your viewpoint today. I appreciate the testimony today. Commissioner, final words on that?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members, and I'm available at any time to be back before you again. And I just see it not as heavy-handed, but as an incentive to invest in Minnesota jobs instead of somewhere else. But I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'm available at any time the committee needs me.
Noted. Commissioner, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Davids has
thank you, Madam Chair. And to the Commissioner, if it's about 3 hours to get from your place to here, it'd be about 3 hours from here to Giants Ridge. Is that what you're saying?
Mr. Chair, 3 hours and 15 minutes, but we can get you a good tea time today.
Thank you, Commissioner. I would just like to announce that on Thursday at 8:15 a.m., we'll be reconvening the conference committee, Room 15 Capitol. We'll be looking at local option sales taxes, and we may reconvene Thursday evening. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Davids. Without further business, this committee is adjourned.